In this edition of the Week in Review, we'll discuss the latest on the travel ban, so-called judges, Congressman Sean Duffy's controversial remarks about white terrorism, Senator Elizabeth Warren getting silenced on the U.S. Senate floor because she persisted, the Nordstrom Trump flap, and what else? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network, and we will be talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top state, national, and international political stories of the week, and we welcome your input, too. Let me welcome our guests. Eugene Kane is a former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Kevin Benversi is with us. He is the research director with Media Trackers. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So let's talk about the very latest with the travel ban. A federal appeals court ruled against reinstating President Trump's executive order that restricts immigration from seven predominantly Muslim nations. The Trump administration says this measure is necessary to keep America safe, while the states filing the lawsuit claimed the order is unconstitutional and targets Muslims. Trump's response to the court order was a tweet that read, in all caps, "See you in court." Kevin, your reaction, what you want to see ultimately happen with this executive order?
Well, there's a bunch of things you could look at on this executive order. I'm not a fan of how it was rolled out. As a conservative, I think what you have in this White House, and I call them the Steves because, well, that's their names. You have two guys, Steve Bannon and Steve Miller, who want to be very hardline on immigration and a very hardline against attacking Islamic terror. So they wanted to push this out on the nearly day one. The problem is, in an administration, you can't push things like this out on day one without it looking as much as a, you know, as foobarred as the situation has become, to put it in a military term, in the sense that you don't have your team at the Justice Department. You don't have the lawyers there at your legal counsel telling you, Mr. President, this might work, but that would work, but if you word it this way, it would work better, or Mr. President, so on and so forth. So you have this White House, which at least when it comes to this executive order, has been at ramming speed to get it done. I was not a fan of throwing in anyone with a green card into this executive order, and everything I've heard from legal scholars like Alan Dershowitz, who this morning was on Morning Joe, said this, is that legally, on a legal basis, the White House has the argument and has the legal standing because of a 1952 law passed by Congress, which gives the president the executive authority to determine immigration status and who can get it and who cannot get it. So it's not a question of can the president do this. It's a question of can the president do this smartly. And the thing is, to get this done right, they have to do either one of two things. Take the months and the time to get it done right, or two, revise the order so that they don't have to be hung up in the courts as they clearly decided to do with this one.
Mm-hmm. Eugene, what do you think?
Well, on the travel ban itself, I mean, I think – And a lot of people have always thought it was unconstitutional, discriminatory. It certainly is a religious test, which is not supposed to be what this country is about. The rollout, of course, everybody seems to agree it was bungled. But I think it's even more, I think, serious that this is his first major initiative, Trump's first major initiative, and he had his team handle it, and they basically bungled it. So that doesn't give me any real big confidence in this new administration. And I'm just surprised at the rationales they're using. The main one that seems to be missing for me is what is the dire state of emergency that made them want to rush this thing through. I think that's what people are seeing through. It's Trump back in the election in the campaign mode where he's basically trying to scare everybody with this idea that we're all going to be blown up by terrorists tomorrow. And this ban actually kind of presumes that there's some kind of emergency threat that's looming that most people in government or in national security intelligence have already kind of complained that, well, there really isn't any real threat right now. So what was the need to rush this through like this? I think for a lot of us, it's just come more confirmation that this guy, I mean, Trump, doesn't really know what he's doing.
Yeah, well, the president is saying, paraphrasing, you know, that bad people are pouring into the country because this travel ban or immigration, temporary immigration ban, has been halted. Kevin, is there, I mean, do you think that bad people are pouring into the country because of this?
Well, to take off what Eugene said about what was the emergency, I think the emergency wasn't in the Trump administration and the higher echelons. Thoughts, their thinking process was, this is a campaign promise, we're going to do this. Say what you want about what they're doing, what this administration campaigned on, they are doing it. So, you know, it's not like this wasn't warned or this wasn't coming. I think the idea that this is a quote-unquote Muslim ban is a little overbroad and overreaching. The seven nations that were encompassed in this were all pointed out and all collectively gathered in 2015 by the Obama administration. The reality of it is, even with this restraining order, six of the countries on this list will probably, you know, they'll have no issues going forward. Syria, which is the real trouble spot and the real worry for a lot of people in state and the intelligence community, those folks were never going to get it anyway because they couldn't prove anything status. We were barely letting refugees from Syria in the first place. So I can understand. And again, my thinking is these guys have rushed this through so fast without proper whatever. I mean, look the whole situation with Sally Yates as acting attorney general. I was a former political appointee in the Bush administration. And, you know, you knew that, you know, one of the things, if you were a holdover, you don't, you know, do this. It doesn't matter if you agree with the policy or not. You are not dictated to act in a quote unquote heroic way for, you know, political or policy purposes. You are there to basically be there as an administrator until your replacement comes in. So the problem is, again, from this White House, is that they are such at ramming speed to get these things through that they're not, I would say, prepared on so many levels to fight the legal fights, to fight the policy fights, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Well, Camille on Facebook writes, it's pretty sad when Assad, Syrian President Bashar Assad, says some of the refugees are terrorists and the U.S. won't give the president the power to protect the citizens of the country. Apparently, Assad has said there are definitely terrorists among the refugees fleeing his nation's civil war. The evidence of this claim, Assad said, is easily found on the internet.
Another Trump, I guess.
But, and that was part of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in their decision when they would not lift the temporary restraining order on the ban. They said that they wanted to review the threat and the administration wouldn't give them any evidence that there was a threat. Eugene?
That's because that information is classified and probably there's people inside the White House who haven't seen that information yet either.
Yeah, but I guess courts see that kind of information when in a situation like this is my understanding. But Eugene, your reaction?
If I can just point out, I think the biggest red herring in this whole thing is the way that the Trump administration constantly refers to, well, we didn't pick these six countries. These are Obama's countries. Well, the way I understand it, Obama administration did identify these countries as being places where terrorists traveled freely and pointed out there was a need for better vetting. But to say that Obama ever had this kind of travel ban in play is simply false. And, I mean, it's amazing the way that just gets glossed over in any reporting of this. They just say, well, it's not the Trump's list, it's the Obama's list. Okay, Obama had countries on a list, but did he actually prohibit travel to the degree that this travel ban did? So clearly there wasn't any emerging threat or clear imminent danger during those years. I mean, I think Trump is just, again, he's putting out this false narrative, and to a large degree, the media just buys it and doesn't question it.
Roger in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Roger.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My comment is as regards Mr. Kane saying something to the effect of there's no immediate threat, there's no identified threat. With all due respect to Mr. Kane, I remember September 11th, 2001 vividly. On September 10th of 2001, there was no imminent threat that we were aware of. On September 1st of 2001, no imminent threat. And I'd like to use a very brief analogy. I keep the door lock to my house. I keep a door lock on that. I keep it locked. You know, I've never been burglarized, but I still get to lock the door.
All right, thanks, Roger. So you got to be preemptive here, Eugene, is what Roger's saying. Your reaction to that?
Well, you're buying into this fear game that Trump is using. I mean, I don't dispute that this is dangerous times and things are out there that might basically, you know, put us in jeopardy. But since 2001, since September 11, 2001, that has been a game that people carried on a stick that a lot of people, politicians in particular, have used to sort of try to coerce Americans into accepting anything that a president says. And back then it was Bush, and I guess during Obama years there was some of it too. But my attitude is that you have to reject that attitude that, oh, things are so dangerous that I got to lock my door at night. That is simply not being reasonable in terms of to the true spectrum of what's going on now, right now with terrorism. And I just won't accept that a president tries to kind of scare the public into accepting his demands, which is why I'm glad this appeals court struck him down on this, because he clearly didn't come up with enough rationale for these judges to be okay with his ban.
Kevin?
I don't think the technical term is he got struck down by the Ninth. It's just what they did was they kept the temporary restraining order that the circuit court judge in Washington stated. Let's actually get technical. I mean, we could play legal technicalities here all we want. One thing I will say about what Eugene was saying, that the Obama administration never did this. In 2011, they actually barred refugees from Iraq for 180 days. Nobody went to ballistic about that. So the idea that, again, the president can't do this or can't target individual countries, which is actually what's happening. The president can target individual countries. He can't target individual people or groups. And that's where you're seeing this blurred line about, oh, it's a Muslim ban, because everyone's like, oh, these are all, you know, 90%, you know, 98, 99% Muslim countries. But the problem is they're also very known to have a high degree of, you know, terrorists, you know, and terrorist origins in there, like Yemen and Sudan, I believe, are on the list. So it's not a question of that. So it's just one of these things where, and, you know, I tend to think where I stumbled on the thought here. But, you know, that's kind of my take on it there. So
let's take our break, and then we have callers who want to get in on this. We need to move on to some related topics. We'll talk about Trump calling the Seattle judge who put the stay on his executive order, calling him a so-called judge, and the reaction from that. We'll also talk about Congressman Sean Duffy from Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District getting some national attention over his comments on this situation. And we'll welcome any other comments you might have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top news stories of the week, and we're welcoming your thoughts and the issue in the news this week that you would like to discuss. We're talking about right now the travel ban and related issues. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin Benversi is one of our guests. He is the research director with Media Trackers, and Eugene Kane is our other guest, former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. As we have been talking about a federal appeals court, the Ninth District Court of Appeals ruled against reinstating President Donald Trump's executive order that restricts immigration from 7 predominantly Muslim nations. And we have full lines on this, so we'll take a couple more calls, and then we do have to move on to some other issues, as it is the Week in Review, and we go from issue to issue. Rose in Cumberland is with us. Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Go ahead, Rose.
I just have a comment about the Muslim ban. You know, just because the apple tree has a few bad apples doesn't mean you cut down the entire tree. You just cut off a few branches. You don't ban a bunch of countries because they're bad people. And there's been terrorists pouring into this country for the past 300 years, and you can ask the Native Americans, because us white people were the first ones. But, I mean, look at the coal pipeline. They're not getting very far on it because they can't have their say.
All right. Thank you very much, Rose. I'm actually going to go to Shyla in Hartford next. Hi, Shyla.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My quick comment, this is in response to your earlier caller, Roger, as well as one of your panelists talking on this topic, which is, you know, the terrorist attack in 2001 and the effect on our country. But Saudi Arabia is where all those terrorists came from in 2001. Pakistan is a hotbed of terrorism in the world today. You know, even the attacks that happened within the U.S. recently were Pakistani origin or some sort of training there. But those weren't included in the ban. So this ban by itself, you know, there's something smells bad about it. Why weren't Saudi Arabia and Pakistan involved in this?
Do you know why, Kevin?
Litany of reasons. Sadly, things that both sides of the aisle should not exactly be proud of. There's numerous business ties in Saudi Arabia that you don't want to upset. The House of Saud is already on limited footing with a lot of its own fighting internally dealing with Islamic terrorism, so you don't want to put them on the defensive. And in Pakistan, a lot of that is Cold War posturing that's been held on for decades and decades. I mean, say what you like. I mean, essentially, some of this list was picked because it is kind of the low-hanging fruit in the world of terrorist nations that you could easily identify. And then there weren't other aspects that would upset folks at either the state, justice, or defense departments.
And briefly, our first caller who said, hey, you know, you don't shut down immigration from seven countries because there might be a terrorist among them all. That, you know, they're you try to target the bad guys. You don't punish everybody. Kevin, do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, that's what the point of having all this ban essentially did is try to create a window for increased vetting. No one questions the need to increase and improve vetting of people who are coming into this country. Therein lies the question again: is could they have done it better? I believe they could have. I mean, I believe immensely they should have. But, I mean, the idea that you can't block people from certain countries from coming into this country, there is actually, again, a legal precedent that a president can do this, and the presidents have had this ability since a law was passed in 1952. So every president since Harry Truman has had this ability. As I said before, President Obama did it in 2011 with Iraq. Jimmy Carter did it in 1979 with Iran. So there are situations where if you believe, you know, national security is at risk, and that is what the Trump administration is arguing in court, you know, the president has that prerogative. The question now is, a lot of what's actually coming out of these rulings, if you read them, there's no actual mention whatsoever that the ban is unconstitutional. What's being argued is essentially by some of these judges in circuit and the appeals court is they don't like how it was implemented. So therein lies, again, the question is they could either take the months to get their argument right or they could revise the order.
Randy in Keewaskum is with us. Hi, Randy.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. The thing is, the litigants chose their venue because the Ninth Circuit, I mean, it's been referred to as the Ninth Circus Court of Repeals because it is the most reversed court in the nation. And Trump's attacks on the court, though imprudent, I don't like to see them, aren't unprecedented in considering Barack Obama lashed out and attacked the U.S. Supreme Court during his State of the Union speech the one year. So it's like this venue was picked because these judges tend to make rulings on what they feel things should be rather than what the actual law is.
A reaction, Eugene, to that charge. Two of the three judges are considered left-leaning. One of the judges in the Ninth Circuit was appointed by a Republican president.
Yeah, and I've heard that again about this Court of Appeals. My attitude is that it's still law. It's the law is the law. I mean, people are making excuses as to, you know, why Trump's ban wasn't upheld for political reasons. And again, it gets into the issue of the credibility of the judicial system. And now we have a president who's basically made a reputation off slamming judges, you know, either for their ethnic background or for their political orientation. And it just gets to a point where it's really hard to see this happening in this country and people missing the fact that it's not just having a president who seems to want to run roughshod over this. But getting back to Trump's campaign against Muslims, which he basically did run a campaign against Muslims, now what you have is that American public, they're willing to kind of accept all kind of stuff because the Muslim community has been demonized by President Trump during his campaign, and now even it seems while he's in office. And that's just a very serious thing. And to say it's not a religious ban, and part of the ban is that he's going to give a break to Christians living in these predominantly Muslim countries because they are an oppressed minority, it's just amazing how many red flags this thing should be raising. But after a year of having him campaign for this stuff, it seems like a lot of Americans have just fallen asleep and just have realized that, oh, there's nothing we can do about this. Thankfully, Ninth Court of Appeals showed us that there is something you can do about it. He's president. He's not the king.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the President Trump calling that Seattle judge who put a stay initially on the order. He called that Seattle judge a so-called judge. A lot of that didn't sit well with Judge Neil Gorsuch, who is Trump's pick to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. Gorsuch has been meeting with senators ahead of his confirmation, and according to Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal and others who have since confirmed this, Gorsuch called Trump's comment disheartening and demoralizing. How big a deal is this, do you think, Eugene? Trump's response, and for that matter, Gorsuch's response to him?
Well, I have to admit, being a kind of political junkie, I've kind of listened to the theory that what's happening with Gorsuch, is it Gorsuch? I'm sorry if I mispronounced it.
It's pronounced different ways. I've been saying Gorsuch, but I think I've heard others say it that way, too.
But my attitude is that it is actually something credible to the idea that maybe Gorsuch has decided to criticize Trump with reporters and with congresspeople and then made sure it got out because he wants to send the impression that he's independent, which actually, when I think with Schumer, Chuck Schumer brought up that it might be sort of like a bait-and-switch game, and he warned colleagues in the Congress not to fall for it unless this guy comes out and talks against Trump's comments about judges more forcefully. I actually could see it as being a sort of undercover thing where he's decided to just put out a little bit critical of Trump so people in Congress think, oh, this guy will be very independent. I actually am questioning that, and I think Schumer, he kind of, you know, crystallize what my thoughts would be on that. It would be a perfect way for him to kind of sneak in under the wire, so to speak. Not really under the wire, but
yeah. Are you at all troubled, Kevin, by turning to President Trump's response that he seems to be ridiculing the judiciary in some of his tweets?
Well, I have two trains of thought on this. Is one, the so-called judge comment was out of bounds. Judge in Seattle was confirmed, has all the credentials and qualifications. So that was, that's classic Trump shooting from the hip, and tweeting first before thinking. Secondly, is presidents have been attacking the judiciary in this country since 1803, since Thomas Jefferson didn't exactly like what Mr. Marshall wrote in Marbury versus Madison. So we have a longstanding tradition, if you wish to call it that, of one branch of government criticizing the other branch of government. And honestly, that's kind of how the system's supposed to work, is that, you know, this, the checks and balances. If you just had, you know, the caller brought up the Obama bringing up the Citizens United case and the State of the Union address as an example of this. Yeah, I mean, it's similar, but it's not similar what Trump did, because Obama, you know, criticized the case, criticized the ruling. Trump criticized the judge, which you don't, you just don't do. That's not, there's not an avenue of decorum for that. There, I think, is what Gorsuch is trying to say, in the sense of you can attack the ruling because everyone has an opinion. Everyone, you know, can say, this is how I saw the law, this is how you see the law. So, but when you attack the judge personally, that is where the disheartening and the disconcerting comments, I believe, applies. Eugene talking about the Senate three-dimensional confirmation chess that's clearly being played by Chuck Schumer there. Did Chuck Schumer say this after meeting Mr. Gorsuch, or has he still not met with him yet? Because what's been happening here, and we could go all day about the confirmation games the Democrats have been playing with this administration since day one. Again, as someone who's been out there in Washington, D.C., who's gone through, I mean, I didn't go through a confirmation fight, but seen confirmation fights for even cabinet positions, this is just beyond the pale. I mean, delaying after delay, basically intentionally saying we're not even going to, it's not even going to matter if these people are qualified. It's just if we don't like the policy they're pushing, they're automatically in no, which is not how it's supposed to go. A cabinet agency is supposed to be an extension of the president, and that president was given the authority to name his cabinet by winning the election. If Democrats don't like that, if liberals don't like that, win the next election.
We'll get into some of the controversial confirmation tactics in just a moment, but I did want to bring up Wisconsin Republican Congressman Sean Duffy's flack that he's catching for his comments during a CNN interview this week. He and anchor Allison Camerata were discussing President Trump's silence about the deaths of six Muslims in a Canadian mosque by a white terrorist. The president had been saying that the media was not reporting on terrorist attacks, that the media was being silent about terrorist attacks. It led to a back and forth about the differences between terrorist attacks by ISIS or Al-Qaeda and by whites in North America. Let's take a listen to that exchange.
Are you going to compare the one attack up in Canada to all the death and destruction in Europe from refugees
or
the attacks in the United States of America?
How about the Charleston church shooting? He was an extremist. So,
yeah.
He was a white extremist.
Yeah, he was. Okay.
How about that? That doesn't matter?
No, it does matter. It does matter. Look at the good things that came from it. Nikki Haley took down the Confederate flag. That was great. Mm-hmm. But you want to say, I can give you a couple examples. Mm-hmm. There's no constant thread that goes through these attacks.
Duffy later clarified his remarks to say that since the white extremists are already in the U.S., law enforcement should find them and take them down, and that we shouldn't take in people from the seven nations in Trump's travel ban because extremists are known to come from there. All right, so Eugene first, what do you make of Sean Duffy's remarks?
Well, he just exhibits the kind of cluelessness that I think a lot of folks have in this country in terms of who to be really afraid of. As African American, I have always had discussions with black people in terms of wondering why the media and government has gotten so agitated or so, you know, exercised over radical Islamic terrorism, so to speak, when in terms of the domestic terrorism that has been present in this country for decades, I mean, we could all do laundry lists of certain incidents and cherry pick what we think is the worst. But I think what we have to do is come to a belief or to an understanding that the most dangerous people in this country right now are not Muslim terrorists to a large degree. A lot of black people could tell you, because their communities are still kind of besieged by a kind of racism that takes place in very terrorist actions and events that aren't really reported. Like Trump is saying, it's not really reported, but it's not reported because it's mainly domestic and white suspects involved as opposed to Muslims or even African Americans. So, I mean, Duffy, he just sounds clueless to me. He's trying to put, you know, to put out his particular spin on things. And again, he would just collapse under the facts of what actually happens in this country if he ever did any real research as to the degree of domestic terrorism versus international terrorism.
Kevin?
Well, I saw both the Camarada interview and then listened to his clarification. It was actually my boss's show, Jerry Bader, on the following day, where he clarified a lot of what he's saying. I would, you know, the CNN interview was not Sean Duffy's best TV. I'll give you guys that. But I also think that interview kind of came off or felt very ambushy. I mean, there were things where I'm going, why the heck is he being asked about that? Or talking points that Ms. Camarada was using that frankly came straight out of left-wing blogs, in my opinion. I mean, like, where is she? I mean, she literally said, you know, more people are killed with lightning strikes than terrorism. I'm going, where the heck did you get this information from? But also, there's also the political aspect of this. This wouldn't have become news if the fact that Sean Duffy is seen as a very credible, very real threat to Tammy Baldwin in the U.S. Senate seat next year. And there is an effort among left-wing media, particularly the Huffington Post, to try to wall up protection for Senator Baldwin going into that fight. So that being said, I mean, I think Duffy could have, you know, gone into the interview a lot better. His clarification, especially around the South Carolina stuff, was much better. And, you know, knowing Sean as I have for a number of years, you know, was the real thing, was his real stance on things. It wasn't this ambush style that came out of the CNN interview.
Let's Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. Well, I mean, Trump and company are right in the sense that the media doesn't report some of these incidents equally, but he's totally on the wrong side. Not only does Trump list terrorist actions and keep out white supremacist cases, but if I invite your listeners to see the last segment of Democracy Now! This morning, two cases. The very day that Trump is saying that the media doesn't cover cases of Muslim terrorists, a trial begins in Tennessee of a white extremist with a planning to go to upstate New York to assassinate Muslims, not covered at all in the media that I've heard. And then there's a Bowling Green massacre. So she makes this mistake, says it's a massacre, and then the media reports, well, there was really a couple of Muslims that were going to give some aid to extremists in Syria, etc. Well, there was, in fact, a white extremist. He's in prison now. He's got a very short 6-year sentence. Who had already killed a Latino before, was ordered.
I'm sorry, Art. I know there's a lot there, and I don't mean to be rude and cut you off, but I guess the point being, in our limited time, that the media is not doing a good job covering terrorist attacks by domestic terrorism by white extremists. Eugene, it sounds like you agree with that.
Well, yeah, I do. And I think the counterpart to that is that we have a president who ran a divisive campaign that basically demonized Muslims in particular, but many other groups too. So that's the thing that we shouldn't lose sight of, that in terms of the state that we're in now, this agitated state of worrying about terrorism, a lot of that comes from the fact that Trump has been stoking that fire for more than a year now.
You know, I'm way past my break time, so I'm going to take the break, and when we come back, we're going to switch topics because we have many more to cover and limited time. We'll talk about I know that President Trump made some controversial remarks about Russia and the U.S., comparing them in a way, and we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about how Elizabeth Warren was rebuked on the Senate floor during the confirmation of I can't remember if it was Jeff Sessions or, yeah, I think it was Jeff Sessions. So we'll talk about that and anything else you'd like to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are, too, reviewing the top news stories of the week from the state, national, and international levels. Our guests are Eugene Kane, former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Kevin Benversi, who is the research director for Media Trackers. And we do have to move on to another story. Let me talk about the Senate confirming Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General, but this was not until after Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts was silenced for reading a letter written by Martin Luther King's widow on the Senate floor. Coretta Scott King wrote the letter 30 years ago to speak out against Sessions when he was being considered for a judicial nomination. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Warren's reading of that letter, the excerpt of the letter, was in violation of Senate rules for impugning the motives of Sessions. Here's what McConnell had to say.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
That last part, "she persisted," has become a bit of a rallying cry for Warren supporters on social media. Kevin, do you think that this backfired on Republicans and Mitch McConnell to put the kibosh on Warren's speech, or what?
I tend to be of the belief that it wasn't the smartest thing to do at the time, because it essentially has now made her a martyr, especially in the online left. Then again, she was always a martyr for the online left, so it's not really a question of what damage they're doing. I mean, she's going to get a boatload of online donations if she hasn't already. The real question, and this is, again, we're dealing with that wonderful third-dimensional chess that happens in the Senate, is, was this then an attempt to make her the face of the Democratic Party? Because, you know, say what you want about Elizabeth Warren, you know, if you want your face to be a liberal from Massachusetts for the Democratic Party, that's ended up actually fairly well for Republicans and conservatives, especially on a presidential level. I believe they're 0-3, Democrats are. So, but the realities of it was, I think they should have just, you know, nobody would have known about it. It would have been her speech would have been a YouTube thing that only her most diehard supporters would have found intriguing. And none of us would have even known she said anything about the King letter. But that being said, and, you know, these confirmation fights, because of the way the Democratic base is demanding things upon the Senate Democrats, have gotten to the point of just out of control. They're, you know, as I said before, we're now fighting people based on the policies that the president is about to push, which was supposed to be what the election was about. And voting yes, yay, or nay about them versus the qualifications and their fitness for office. So,
yeah. On the McConnell Warren's flap, Eugene, do you think Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says McConnell owes Warren an apology? Do you think that McConnell should say he's sorry?
Well, he probably isn't sorry, so I'm not much into empty apologies. But what this whole incident did to me was remind me again of how astounding it was that 53% of white women voted for Trump. And it just shows you that this was clearly one of the more sexist acts in government that I have seen in a while. And it's buttressed by the fact that weren't there like three other male senators who wanted to read the same thing who were allowed to do it without being cut off?
Yes.
And that's, again, you know, for any woman who is looking at this, I just can't understand why they don't stand up for their own interests, because this was clearly, and again, you can talk, Kevin can talk about her being sort of like a left-wing icon or whatever. She's standing up for what's right. I mean, the whole thing about Jeff Sessions is that he has this murky racial past in Alabama, of course, one of the more racist southern states in the nation. And there are black people who were born and raised in Alabama, and I've talked to at least one of them in the last month, who pointed out that he was considered one of the worst racial politicians in a place that was known for oppressive racial policies. So the backlash against Sessions wasn't just some political left-wing thing. I think it was really the remnants of a civil rights movement trying to tell America just what a travesty it would be if a guy like this was made one of the more important, you know, law enforcement, civil rights protectors in this country. So, yeah, I think the Elizabeth Warren thing was very embarrassing, mainly because it was very sexist. It's a female politician who got put in her place.
Let me I'm going to bring in a call from Paul in Greendale. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I'm just wondering if Kevin would like to comment on the fact that Barack Obama's appointments, on average, took longer than any president since 1977. So when those on the right say, just, you know, pass these appointments through, well, let's take a minute and look at how long it's really taken for most of these appointments. And, you know, no problem slowing down some of these appointments because, hey, it's tit for tat.
Yeah, and I also wanted to get a quick reaction to Betsy DeVos confirmation, historic confirmation, in that Vice President Mike Pence had to break the tie 50-50 when two Republicans joined Democrats in their opposition to Betsy DeVos to be Education Secretary, believing her to be unqualified because she does not have public school experience. Kevin?
To answer the caller's point first about tit for tat and all that other stuff, what I mean by letting these people through, I'm talking the original team, the original cabinet. There's always been a level of decorum, a level of respect handed to the incoming president that he should be given the team he wants at the start of his administration. That's always kind of been a universal thing. That's at least always been respected. Barack Obama, by this time, I believe had like 90% of his cabinet confirmed. Same with George W. Bush, same with Clinton. Bush's father may have been the only exception because of the high amount of turnover between the Reagan and the Bush administrations. So, I mean, even former Democratic Senator Russ Feingold, who took a lot of heat from liberals in 2001 when he voted to confirm John Ashcroft as George W. Bush's original attorney general, said, "I believe the president should have the team he wants." That's my stance. That's always kind of been my stance. It's an understandable, defensible, honorable stance that at least on the day one of his presidency, a president should be given what they want. Beyond that, I can understand, yeah, there's a political game about attorney generals and all these other things, Loretta Lynch, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, going on.
Well, I'm going to jump in only because Kevin.
I'm going on. I know, and I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in so we don't go on and on and on. Very briefly, Eugene, you have a response to whether the Democrats are right or wrong in trying to perhaps slow down or defeat these cabinet appointees, or should the president get who he wants?
Well, I think because of this president and this particular candidate and during the election and the things he said and the things he demonstrated that showed, you know, what he really thinks about where this country should be going, this is a time to fight him tooth and nail, actually, because I don't take it very lightly. I think he's very dangerous to the future of this country. I hope it doesn't turn out like that. I would support America being successful under Trump, but so far, it's just I don't have any problems with fighting him every part of the way, because the people he's picking are the wrong people in my mind and in a lot of other people's minds. So why wouldn't you fight it?
Well, we have a caller who wants to bring up this particular clip that I am going to play. So President Trump generated some controversy with a comment he made during his pre-Super Bowl interview with Bill O'Reilly. He said that he respects Russian President Vladimir Putin and that it's better to get along with him than not, especially over the fight against ISIS. Then he said this, which had many people talking.
Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though.
Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why do you think our country's so innocent?
So let's take Mark in Appleton now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I mean, you can just imagine we had 8 years in which the right questioned President Obama's patriotism, whether he was American, his religion. And now you have Trump go on and say something. I mean, just imagine if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama had said the same thing. I mean, it would have been nonstop on right-wing radio, on TV. They would have been calling for impeachment. And it goes almost, except for Senator John McCain, almost unnoticed.
All right, thanks, Mark. And very briefly, Kevin, why do you think conservatives or Republicans aren't riled up by that?
I think, and this is sadly a state of affairs that we saw unfold during campaign 2016, is that we are now a country in which political tribalism trumps things like, you know, just basically understanding of what American exceptionalism and versus our role in the world. I, too, was horrified, as the listener was, to what President Trump said in his moral equivalence between Putin and what in America. So, I mean, you know, I'm one of these never Trump Republicans. I mean, I used to work for Charlie Sykes, so trust me. I mean, it's been a fun 7 months for me on so many levels.
Steve in Danbury wants to talk about the Trump Conway Nordstrom thing. So very briefly, Steve, what's your take on that?
Well, I think I hear your Republican guest trying to normalize a lot of what Trump is doing. And what we're really seeing is unprecedented here from a president. And your screener asked me for one example, and that was just the quickest, most recent one I could think of, Kellyanne Conway going on national television and plugging the product of one of Trump's offspring, which we've never seen before. It's already going to be brought up in the House Ethics Committee. She's already going to be investigated for this. But day after day after day, this stuff goes on and on. And
thank you, Steve. We are almost out of time. Nordstrom dropped Ivanka Trump's clothing line this week, which prompted President Trump to launch a Twitter attack against the company, saying his daughter was treated so unfairly. Then Kellyanne Conway also said that people should give Ivanka's company their business, and that set off a firestorm. She has been counseled, apparently, on this matter. Do you share any of our caller's concerns, Eugene?
Well, of course. I mean, my thing about Trump is that if you notice, even his surrogates, from Kellyanne Conway to Sean Spicer, they start incorporating some of his stuff in their comments, and I don't think they understand that, you know, it's making them look bad. I doubt if either one of them will have a real good career after this because they've been so damaged by a lack of credibility by linking themselves with Trump. So, yeah, I'm very – and then one other thing. I actually liked Ivanka Trump until this Nordstrom thing came up because it makes her seem like she's, like, whining to daddy about her clothing line has been dropped, and now that got into a political political stream.
We have only 30 seconds. I'm sorry, Kevin. A brief react, especially to the Nordstrom thing.
Kellyanne Conway is in some trouble, and she should be. Again, as a former political appointee, you can't do this. It's a bit like, you know, you can't endorse products, you can't defend products. I can understand where Trump's going and trying to be a father defending his daughter, but he too should know, as president of the United States, you cannot, you know, do that in the sense of attacking a private company because they did harm to your daughter.
Yeah, too much news for the hour that we had. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We'll talk state news and the state budget coming up on our state capital report on Monday. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.